It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the work of training the next generation of physicians and the evolving healthcare landscape with Dr. Robert Golden, Dean of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health since 2006. He announced recently his intent to step down once a successor is named. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Golden also serves as Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs at UW-Madison. Dr. Golden, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So UW-Madison reporting, you are one of the longest serving medical school deans in North America. Why this moment? Why are you stepping down from the position as dean?
Well, I've been thinking about it for some time. I think it's helpful for institutions every so often to get new leadership with fresh ideas. And as I thought about it, though, it was announced that our chancellor, Becky Blank, would be moving on. And I decided that I wanted to try to play a role in selecting the new leadership for campus and orienting the new leadership. And now, once again, we have an incredibly strong chancellor, an incredibly strong provost in place. The school is doing great. So I thought it was an appropriate time to pass the baton.
Can you give us any insight into what the search is like to hire a new dean?
Well, it varies from place to place. But at UW, we put into place the proud tradition of shared governance. So it's a inclusive process. The process usually takes about a year or so from start to finish. And it includes not only the school, but other perspectives within the university and among alumni and among other constituents.
Okay, so it's really a shared process, and it sounds like then you will stay in this role until that new person is named.
Yes, absolutely. I hope to welcome the new person and then step away so that they can create their vision and move things forward.
All right, you have a long lens here since 2006 as dean. What do you think is your proudest achievement?
Well, I think our school, and the achievement is really an achievement of our faculty and our staff, our school has become a national leader in advancing a new model for academic medicine. It's a model that integrates medicine and public health. And what that means is across our missions, including research, training, and especially service, we emphasize not only the diagnosis and treatment of disease, but also the prevention of disease and the promotion of health. And we really take a holistic view of not only the person and the patient, but also the population, with an emphasis on populations that struggle with health disparities. And I think this integrated model of medicine and public health is really where the nation needs to be going if we're going to really advance the health and well-being for all.
It sounds like more of a holistic approach to medicine.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting because at other fine institutions, there are schools of medicine and schools of public health, oftentimes quite literally across the street from one another. But they don't really come together and have their own silos. So we want to have a real integrative approach. And along the lines of integration, another wonderful accomplishment of the institution over the last several years was the bringing together of the School of Medicine and Public Health's academic group practice with what was a hospital, now a health system. And all too often, there is unfortunately a tension between the priorities of a medical school emphasizing research and education and a health system. But we brought those together in a way that is also now a national model, so that the health system is a physician-run organization that understands the importance of bringing together both the academic missions and the clinical service missions. And I think that model also is gaining a lot of attention and is responsible for much of the success in UW Health in the past 7 years or so.
Dr. Robert Golden with us. At the end of January, Golden announced he's stepping down from the position as Dean of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Looking back at his tenure and looking ahead as well, you can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. In 2007, you helped launch the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine, and this training space was created for med students just 1 year after you started your position as dean. How is this academy filling the need for rural healthcare workers?
Well, it's playing an important role in addressing the shortage of physicians in rural communities, and the way it is structured is we select students into the program based on predictors that they will, in fact, practice in rural areas. So the standards for admission are very high, but we put more of an emphasis on those things that are predictive, that they will go back to rural communities in Wisconsin. Then when they come here, their first phase of education, the first year and a half or so, is with everybody else, with some extra additional training in aspects of rural medicine. But then for their clinical years, they largely spend most of their time practicing in rural sites in Wisconsin. And the goal is to create a cohort of really well-trained physicians who will practice in rural sites, especially in our state. So far, the success has been enormous. We have a very high stick rate of graduates of the program who, in fact, practice in rural Wisconsin, many of whom going back to their home communities where they grew up. So we're very pleased that this is really making a difference. We've also layered on top of that rural residency training tracks. After someone completes medical school, you then need to complete a residency training program in areas such as family medicine, surgery, psychiatry, OBGYN. And in each of those areas, we now have rural residency tracks so that residents at UW can spend some of their residency time training in rural communities. And by doing that, they can see the attractiveness of going to practice here when they're done. So between those two programs, we are making a difference in increasing the supply of physicians. We're also very pleased that we have
I just want to jump in here, because when you mentioned the stick rate of these med students becoming physicians and then returning or going to practice in a rural area, what is a good predictor or indicator that they have the intention and that they will carry through to practice in a rural setting?
That's an excellent question. Well, first of all, where did they grow up? Second of all, what kind of activities do they do while in college or before and after college and applying to medical school? And what are their stated interests and what have they done to pursue those interests? So, for example, if somebody grew up in Rice Lake and they spent their summers while in college volunteering on the rescue squad or working in a nursing home, those are the kinds of characteristics that suggest that they are interested in rural practice. On the other end of the continuum, we also have a program, an MD-PhD program, designed to create physician scientists. And there we'd be looking for somebody who spent their summers doing research in a cancer research lab and who really is showing signs of interest in investigation and research rather than community engagement and service. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things we do so that we can predict people who, in fact, will go back to their rural communities because that's where they have a track record of electing to be engaged.
Dr. Robert Golden is Dean of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at an 18-year tenure as he intends to step aside from that role. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As UW-Madison embarks on a national search this spring for a new leader of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, we're in conversation with Dr. Robert Golden about his 18-year tenure and reflections on the academic training ground for future physicians and healthcare professionals. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask him, as I understand it, there are only 20 of 72 counties in the state that have OBGYNs. I'm wondering if the politics around reproductive health care in Wisconsin are affecting the number of people who apply for the specialty and the training the OBGYN students are getting.
Jane, thank you. Dr. Golden.
Well, that's an excellent question. We have one of the most respected OBGYN residency training programs in the country. But for many years now, we've been very, very concerned about attacks on the program because of restrictions on abortion training, which is actually a requirement to maintain accreditation of the program. So with the Dobbs decision, we had to scramble so that we could maintain our accreditation while, of course, following the law of the land. And so what we have been doing is offering training and abortion services for our OBGYN residents at a site in a neighboring state. And we'll continue to do that until there is much more clarity and stability in the situation here. What has happened is that across the country, in those states where there are tensions and restrictions on obtaining training at your home site for abortion services, there has been an impact on the number of applicants applying to programs in those states. In our case, we still attract really talented, really competitive applicants into our program. And so for now, we are doing quite well, actually. But it is a cloud that we worry will turn into a thunderstorm into the future. So it's something we maintain our alertness on and hope that we can continue to attract people here for OBGYN residency training so that they will fall in love with Wisconsin and stay here in practice and will begin to address the shortages in so many counties across the state that the caller has identified.
Will the potential for future hospital closures in Wisconsin or the closures and the consolidations of obstetrics units, will that affect the ability to produce new OBGYNs here in Wisconsin?
It shouldn't affect the ability to produce them because our training site, our UW health system, is very strong and very vibrant. So we will continue to have a strong clinical base for the training. However, it will have a damaging impact on public health in terms of OBGYN service availability, because in those areas that are not located in Dane County or in Milwaukee, where there are other academic health centers, the closure of public community hospitals and clinics makes it very difficult for there to be viable practices there. And especially in obstetrics, as you can imagine, it's important to have proximity to care so that when a woman goes into labor or in those unfortunate situations where there's a complication, time is of the essence, and having to drive a couple of hours for service can really have bad consequences. So we are very concerned about the closing of community-based systems. Recent events are of concern, not only for OBGYN, but for medical care across the board.
I want to turn our attention to research now. UW-Madison reporting that funding from the NIH, National Institutes of Health, increased during your tenure. 2006, the university receiving $135 million. And then in 2022, the university receiving $246 million. What is an example of how this funding is furthering medicine in Wisconsin?
Well, we made a strategic decision to maintain our emphasis on exciting individual projects by our faculty, but at the same time, to really increase our capacity for doing big science with very large interdisciplinary projects. And so, for example, we have a very vibrant Institute for Clinical and Translational Research, which receives a large grant to maintain opportunities for that type of bench-to-bedside translational research. And we also have several programs that are growing dramatically. Our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center has recently been renewed. One of the investigators affiliated with that, Sterling Johnson, just received a $150 million grant to do to lead a national study looking at biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. Hmm. We are traditionally very, very strong in cancer. That's been an area of wonderful growth with our Comprehensive Cancer Center grant, the only one in Wisconsin recently getting a wonderful score and renewal. We also have traditional strengths in other areas ranging from asthma to other areas that include transplantation.
Well, let me ask you this. How dependent is the med school on this grant funding? When you discuss, you know, when you say bench to bedside, like you have to keep your position as competitive research institution. You have to keep these grants coming to keep these research projects going. But then you also have to have that training ground for med students who are at the bedside being able to deliver this type of medicine. How important are these grants?
Oh, well, they're exceptionally important in many ways. The largest source of funding for our school are these competitive NIH grants. We get much more of our budget from these competitive grants than we do from the public support from the state, which amounts to about 7% of our budget. So it's very important. But beyond the dollars, it's really important because we believe that research and education and patient care are all synergistic. Our patients benefit from access to cutting-edge treatments and clinical trials that make available promising new therapies when the current therapies are not working. We want our students to learn how to learn and to not only practice the status quo, but to be able to think to where the puck is going when it comes to cutting-edge new approaches to diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of disease. And we also think that our students bring wonderful questions. They question dogma, and that in turn can spark new ideas for research avenues to see, well, why are we doing it this way? Maybe there's a better way of doing it. And also our patients benefit from having learners and teachers together at the bedside so that they can get a variety of perspectives and opinions that can't be obtained if it's a more limited clinical care environment. So we believe that the research is important not only as a source of support for research per se, but because of what it adds to the quality of training and the quality of patient care.
Dr. Robert Golden with us, Dean of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Golden, I want to land here on artificial intelligence and what it is doing to medical training and in medical care. What benefits or problems do you see AI creating for medical practitioners?
Well, I think AI has a lot of promise, and we are pushing forward to help advance that promise. When it comes to things like scanning large data sets to look for clues as to predictors of disease, it can have applications in clinical practice in areas such as radiology and imaging, where complementing the skill of the radiologist can be a machine learning or AI approach to try to spot things that might not be immediately visible to the human eye. It's also very helpful in taking care of some of the important but mundane aspects of care, whether it's prescriptions being refilled so that doctors and nurses can practice their clinical skills rather than being so tied up with things. At the same time, like any kind of treatment, you have to worry about side effects. And as important of the science in medicine is the human touch and the art of medicine. And there are some things that a computer can't do the way a human being, person-to-person contact, can achieve, so that the entire person, the patient, is dealt with in a humanistic way that blends the science that AI can help us advance with the art and humanity of complete patient care.
Dr. Golden, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Golden is Dean of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He also serves as Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs of UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW Oshkosh launches a new school of informatics, working across academic fields to collect, analyze, and manage data that affects our daily lives. Call in with a question. You can share comments about this field of study and its broader applications. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Frank Braun is Dean of the College of Business at UW Oshkosh. Frank, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. So thanks for the invitation.
Yes, you started at UW Oshkosh just over a year ago. And I understand you've been championing the opening of such a school of informatics. Can you give examples of how informatics applies to life in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly. Actually, informatics is, as we refer to it, as digital everything. And actually what we're engaged in at this moment is an informatics exercise. To kind of give you the broader scope of what we define or we think of informatics is, as it's the art, science, technology, and business of digital information in society. And so our objective is to engage the world, region and world, through a interdisciplinary and multidimensional lens to make information more accessible, accurate, timely, useful, meaningful, impactful, and secure, all aspects of the value of informatics. So you can see that informatics is certainly encompassing set of programs, disciplines, everything from cyber to analytics to AI to radio, TV to journalism, all of the things that that make our society work today, if you will. We created this School of Informatics to actually raise awareness and promote all of the various digital disciplines that are in existence and in practice at UW Oshkosh. It's also an opportunity for us to bring together all those disciplines and cross college boundaries. Academia sometimes has more silos, and this is definitely objective to look through things more like a matrix and cross all of those traditional colleges and bring together the disciplines and courses and faculty and students that are engaged directly or as part of their study in the digital study of digital aspects.
Yes,
as
I mean,
it's all those areas.
Yes, it's a broad swath of not just academic disciplines, a broad swath of society and life as we know it. But I understand the school does not have a physical building. What is your intentions there? And are you trying to fill a workforce gap?
Absolutely. And this is in order to bust the boundaries, if you use the term, we created this this matrix school that allowed us to come together across all of those buildings and hallways and offices and create a space that people collaborate. I mean, with the internet and well, since its introduction and heavy use, you know, geography has become less important. Where you are is less important as what you're doing and who you're engaging and who you're connecting with. And so using that same concept, you know, we wanted to have a quick way at the speed of the internet to connect you know, disciplines and faculty and students across, you know, from, well, this actually started over a decade ago. We have a program called Interactive Web Management, which is actually made, is hosted and provided by four different departments across two colleges, you know, so information systems and computer science, digital marketing and multimedia journalism all collaborate in a more shared governance way. So, you know, this was the example of kind of the incubation over a decade of the School of Informatics, where faculty across colleges, across buildings, work together for the benefit of building disciplines and programs that are targeted at career clusters across the state. You know, computerization, you know, computer science, cyber, radio, TV, you know, the communication disciplines, marketing disciplines, AI, cyber, all of those things cross many, many different disciplines. And so we wanted to create an organization, a domain that allowed us to promote and facilitate and incentivize faculty and students to collaborate across those what might have been building dimension or barriers in the past. We have been practicing this. This is just to take that up a level and use a multiplier effect to get more students future ready to be a part of contributing part of the Wisconsin workforce.
We're talking with the Dean of the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh, Frank Braun, about the launch of UW-Oshkosh's School of Informatics. You can join in. Questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Frank, honing in here on the social science aspect, one arm of informatics is examining social aspects to computerization and to big data, and this can include how data impacts jobs or the social forces influencing technology. How important are those social aspects to the study of informatics?
Well, people at the heart of everything we do. So technology is just the tool and enabler of communication. It's real important that the social sciences, you know, understanding the contents, the story, how it's told, the culture in which it's being consumed or transmitted. You know, even artificial intelligence, you know, there's definitely the human social dimensions of that. And so when we think of informatics, is not only looking at the technical, which we think of, you know, the computerization and aspects, you know, the matrix, the computer of the future, but it's really the human factors, you know, it's aspects around language processing or critical thinking or reasoning, you know, empathy, you know, verbal understanding, all of the aspects that how society is going to be affected, how it can be leveraged by using technology. So the social dimensions, you know, I think informatics is kind of a social technical framework and looking at all that continuum, how it works together, and be mindful and purposeful in bringing those aspects together so they're integrated in the course of study, the practice, and the future workforce.
But you bring up artificial intelligence, and so I'm curious about how does this era of expansion and the evolution in generative AI and in chatbots, and how does that all intersect with informatics?
Well, I would say it's probably at its core. It has a high level of attention and focus today. Just if we look at our history, you know, when the first four function calculator came out, and then, you know, ability to search with Google, and then Wikipedia, you know, all of those things, you know, there was, you know, concerns about how this is going to, you know, cause harm or issues with education and how we teach classes. Where ChatGPT and generative AI, you know, large language models are the next, you know, elevation, probably going to the biggest advances in how we're going to leverage and work and collaborate with computerization, big data, AI, if you will, to where it becomes a co-creator, a partner, an accelerator of human inquiry and human thought, and be able to solve bigger problems, think bigger thoughts, and design and create a future that is just evolving as we see the early uses of some of the advanced AI technologies that are coming online for the general population.
And you're working with local businesses to develop the School of Informatics. What have you learned from the business community and business owners about the needs for informatics?
Yeah, so we've been out talking with, I think we've talked about the 30 different companies throughout the mostly Eastern Wisconsin and a few players in Madison, and a really big, large health informatics applications solution provider that's near you, that's a world-class organization.
I think we can wager a guess there.
You know, we might figure out who that is. And they're all really excited about, you know, the opportunity that we're focusing and expanding the career paths, the opportunities. You know, it's like we need it yesterday. We want to be a part of it. How can we help? How can we engage? You know, I think all of businesses, you know, small, large government organizations understand that, you know, technology is the way in which we can do more, be more efficient, effective, influence the social and economic well-being of the stakeholders of which they serve or engage. So they've been very receptive, supportive, and so we now have to catch up and match their expectations as far as where their needs are. So,
and where are their needs? Like, what might a job look like in informatics?
Well, in informatics, if to give you an idea of some of the jobs as I described, all the different dimensions of digital information. Radio, TV, you know, what we're doing today, those that understand the technology, the culture, the types of inquiry, good questions, graphic design, digital marketing. Actually, we have a digital marketing clinic that we have right now, 12 students that are working for small businesses across the state, helping them with their digital presence, their website, their marketing, their social media. So a lot of aspects around, you know, you think about the digital aspects of engaging consumers and the web presence that's been in play, software technology, cybersecurity, a big area. Cyber is from very technical to very social. You know, for example, cyber, you know, some of the biggest breaches are not because they breach the technology, the firewalls. It's they human engineered or social engineered individuals to give up credentials or click on a link or something. So, you know, the social dimensions and of cyber, of analytics, you know, all of those are things. So there's a myriad of disciplines. We were looking at the number of graduates that were in informatics disciplines at UWO. And last year we graduated over 1,000 students, which have either directly or supporting informatics coursework into the workforce. So, when you think of informatics, the ones that come to mind are, you know, the hard sciences, be it or the technical sciences like computer science and information systems, analytics accordingly. But the social dimensions of that, as we go across, are all of the creative environments and things. As I mentioned today, right now we're engaged in informatics, both in the uses of technology, a discussion of information, and the dissemination and inquiry of learning more. That's all what we engage in across the spectrum of informatics.
Frank Braun is Dean of the College of Business at UW Oshkosh. As we explore its recently launched School of Informatics, and you can be part of the discussion at any point, call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As UW Oshkosh launches a School of Informatics, We explore how data-driven analytical skills are being applied to a range of academic disciplines and what that allows students to do and later in life. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Frank Braun is Dean of the College of Business at UW Oshkosh. Frank, Georgetown University started offering a master's in health informatics in 2019, and the school includes classes on the ethics of informatics. What ethical concerns do you have about informatics?
Well, it's been, there's plenty of concerns of misuse or appropriation of informatics or of information of all kinds. The biggest concern would be using advanced computing or data to one, from a health informatics standpoint, we all know the HIPAA laws for information, patient protection of their personal information, identifiable information is a concern. Also, finding and leveraging that information is an aspect. So ethical has been a play since the internet became a reality, in the sharing, unauthorized access, utilization, the deep fakes that come around that are evolving. There's a lot of concerns that are evolving that are in place. Regarding the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information, especially when it comes to health records, there's been challenges on the cyber side of things with attacks of hospital infrastructures, where patient records are not available or they're ransomed, if you will. Healthcare organizations have fallen victim to that. The bad actors really don't seem to have concern for human harm that might come from their technical aspects, more in pursuit of economic gain on their part, wherever they might be in the world.
And it's tricky.
So a lot of concerns regarding that.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky because you want to instill in students that ability to balance privacy and that control over information that is sensitive with the potential for groundbreaking innovations. And so how do you walk that line?
Yeah, absolutely, it's a challenge. I mean, just Dee Golden talked at the conclusion of the last segment regarding use of big data to be able to have better inquiry into medicines, disease diagnostics, and such. So we need to share the information, but not at the detriment of the individual patients. And so the ability to cleanse that or scrub that data, be able to aggregate it and use it and be able to see things much greater and grander, if you will. Talking about that organization, it's just to the west of you, they were very instrumental in leveraging health informatics, big data, to help the government understand when to engage or when to use or not to use ventilators that enhance the effectiveness, the utilization of that. Mm-hmm. And that was health informatics in real time. I mean, I think the COVID in endeavor really brought up our appreciation for the power and the influence of using big data for health inquiry, understanding, surveillance, public health perspectives, having early warning of things diseases or flu or something that might be evolving in certain areas and being able to aggregate that and alert authorities across, the region or globe. Of phenomena that are playing out. And I think we're starting to see that where, there's much heightened awareness and use of informatics technologies for the betterment of society. But unfortunately, as your question, there are the bad actors that may also leverage that. And so containment, security, the cyber part of it, it has to be actively engaged. One of the things that as we're out talking with a lot of the different community members and industry folks is they said as part of technology and informatics, cyber needs to be like your normal, it needs to be part of your plumbing, your electricity. It's just what we do now. It's not an add-on. It should be integrated in how we think, how we go forward, so that we ensure that the individuals that are using this information, this insight, these high computing models are the ones intent on positive outcomes and influencing, you know, the social and economic well-being of all stakeholders.
Using that integrity, yes. Frank Braun with us, Dean of the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh, as we explore its new School of Informatics. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Frank, this is a difficult time for UW-Oshkosh, laying off 140 employees. The total university lost more than 200 positions between layoffs and voluntary retirements recently. How do you balance the excitement of opening a new school in the backdrop of losing university staff?
Absolutely. This has been a trying time, a difficult time for all of the stakeholders at UWO. And it's not unique to Oshkosh. It's across the country. The higher education, you know, regional comprehensives are challenged with enrollment declines, increasing expenses, competition. So it's a perfect storm in some cases. And Oshkosh was certainly caught up in that storm. The School of Informatics, actually, because of its matrix design, is uses a very low-cost model. So we're able to go across, and using technology, we can bridge all these things together. And as part of, you know, reducing the footprint of the school or of the university, we need to find ways to innovate, elevate, and engage. And the School of Informatics was a very efficient and effective way to leverage and move us forward into the new frontier of the future, while the university is reorganizing. Actually, in a week or so, we're going to publish some new academic models that where we may realign the university based on career clusters in alignment with what the state is looking for in job creation and through an informatics lens, future ready kinds of capabilities. So any organization that faces an economic challenge, it causes to rethink, restructure, and renovate the way in which you do things, the way in which you operate, interact with each other, and engage the community.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. So thanks so much for the invitation. And I look forward to working with you and the folks across the state of Wisconsin in the informatics domain. So thanks again for allowing me to be a part of your show this morning.
Appreciate it. Frank Braun, Dean of the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to listener requests, we learn about the latest advancements in heat pump technology to be able to replace a home's furnace and air conditioner and still work effectively when temps fall into the single digits and colder. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts about heat pumps and home energy. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Travis Herzog is a residential estimator and heat pump specialist for Midwest Heating and Cooling, which is based in Maquonago. Travis, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be back.
Well, tell us about the concern with heat pumps struggling to work in cold climates like ours. Is that struggle legitimate?
You know, it is if you're putting the wrong equipment in. So there are various types of systems that are considered heat pumps. They come in varying degrees of where their temperature points are, where they want to change over. It's about selecting the right equipment because they do make actually cold climate rated systems.
Okay, so these systems, I mean, there are air source, there are geothermal. Can you kind of walk us through what are these types of different systems?
Yeah, so your air source system is similar to something that would be like your air conditioner outside. The difference is that there's a coil above your furnace called an evaporator coil, and normally an air conditioner just that gets cold. Well, there's a reversing valve in an air source system that will reverse that to get warm. So that'll allow your air-to-air systems in your home, so furnaces, those types of things, to warm your home. Geothermal uses a water loop, so it's got a little bit more technology in the all self-contained system. There's nothing outside.
Okay. Well, so last year we heard from a caller, Steve in Lake Geneva, and Steve said heat pump technology needs to transition to using natural refrigerants over synthetic to help with decarbonization.
We need to electrify the global economy to rapidly decarbonize, and heat pump technology can play a critical role, and the use of natural refrigerants is key to helping drive down emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions.
What can you tell us there, Travis? Are heat pumps trending toward natural refrigerants?
Yeah, great question. We are starting to see the changeover from 410 to the new R32 refrigerants. That's going to be something that they roll out over time. But there are units that are capable of doing that now, and we'll see that roll out, and then we'll see more and more refrigerants go to the more, environmentally friendly.
So are these refrigerants used as, like, defrosting technology to try to keep heat pumps from icing over?
No, they're not used for defrosting. The thing is if you get the right heat pump, normally you're putting some type of drain pan heater to back it up, or they're built in these cold climate units so they don't freeze over.
Okay. So what is the refrigerant then doing?
The refrigerant is actually mixing in the compressor. It's either going, it actually goes out hot. It goes through a cooling cycle, and it comes back cold for cooling, where in the reverse side, it goes out cold and it comes back warm for heating. So it actually is both heating and cooling that coil, and then the blower from your furnace or air handler unit is forcing that air into your ductwork.
We're talking about heat pumps and heating systems with Travis Herzog, residential estimator at Midwest Heating and Cooling. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff in Delafield is here. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to add an interesting topic. I had two heat pumps installed this week, in fact, on Monday. And mine is probably more of a hybrid system where at a certain temperature it switches back to the gas furnace, but it will heat the house as a heat pump down to, I think it's capable of like 35 degrees. They set it a little bit higher than that. But what really sold me is that it's a very high efficient air conditioner, and the fact that I could get some of the benefits of a heat pump down to a certain temperature kind of sold me on the concept. So I'm very excited to see how this works, especially now as it's into the temperature range where that'll be the primary source of heat for the house. Thanks.
And Jeff, thank you for sharing and the timing here of that had happened this week. I'm wondering, is it integrated then into your current furnace system, or how is the system integrated to what you had or have?
I had to replace the furnaces. I had a failure back a couple weeks ago, one of those really cold days. So when the consultant or salesman, whatever you want to call him, came in, he talked about the heat pump, and I said, hey, I kind of like that idea.
I see. Jeff, thank you. Travis, what comes up for you in this scenario?
So when you're talking about heat pumps, they're all integrated as one full communicating system. So when you're replacing one thing, you're generally replacing the entire system. So your indoor unit, your coil, your outdoor unit,
and even at times a thermostat that all communicates, because it needs to tell the furnace when to be a furnace and when to be a heat pump. And that lockout temperature, you know, 35 degrees or so is kind of standard, but you actually will have ones like I have a customer who insulated properly and actually has their set to negative 10 degrees and is running all heat pump with no issues.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, if you do have your home, you know, re-sided and re-insulated and it's really airtight, but, you know, that is really costly. And then in turn, it's like you can also look to getting a new furnace or a heat pump system. But that too, you know, a heat pump system really needs that insulated quality of the home. What can you say to that? Because these are two competing expenses, it seems.
Absolutely. So I work very closely with a lot of the people that work in the energy sector and like some of our ally partners. And top down is really the way we look at it. It's a holistic approach where we want to see that insulation value. We want to see your energy bills. We want to know how much energy you're using, and we want to calculate what's best for you. So in some scenarios, you can do all electric, and others you can, you know, go dual fuel with a furnace and a heat pump, some just air handler and heat pump. But I definitely go the extra mile to make sure my customers understand what they're doing.
So if you have a gas-powered furnace as your backup and it will, you know, turn to your furnace in times of a particular temperature, whether it's, you know, 5 degrees, 10, 35, 40, you know, you still, is it, do you still have two separate units, one indoors and one outdoors, or are these totally different types of gas-powered furnaces to talk with the heat pump technology?
No, you have an outdoor unit and an indoor unit. So the indoor unit is just going to be your furnace or air handler. It could be either or. Your outdoor unit, there's different styles of heat pumps. Some are cube shaped like a traditional air conditioner,
mm-hmm.
and some are more like slender box shaped like a ductless system. If you've ever seen one of those outdoors, but it'll be a lot more slender unit. But it does the same thing: heats and cools your home, and usually are very, very efficient, like our last caller said.
Travis Herzog is a residential estimator and heat pump specialist at Midwest Heating and Cooling. Call in with a question. You can share your comments about heat pump technology, about home energy. 800-642-1234 is the number. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore advancements in cold climate heat pump systems to heat and cool homes and whether these new models could potentially replace a gas furnace backup during a Wisconsin cold snap. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Travis Herzog with us, who is an HVAC estimator in Maguanago. Travis, last year, half of all American states promised to quadruple the number of heat pump installations across the country by 2030. What do you see in terms of demand for heat pumps?
Yeah, great question. We see a significant increase in them. Even people that look at a full replacement system, once, you know, they don't know a lot about a heat pump, once you kind of explain the technology and where it's going, it's definitely a positive for everything. There's not really a downside to getting one.
So do you see it as a growing piece of your business?
Yeah, I see it as kind of the future of it as we try to kind of lower our carbon footprint. This is the best way to do that in the HVAC industry.
Let's bring in Doug in Mauston. Doug, hi. Go ahead. What's your question?
Hi. I built my house 27 years ago, and I have an air-to-air heat pump in it, and it's been wonderful, but it's now time to replace it. And a big tout now is I know mine was only good to about 25 and 32 degrees outside. It would just barely maintain the heat in the house. And now they're talking that these newer units, down to zero and 15 below can still heat your house. What is the technology that makes that possible?
Yeah, good question. It's actually an inverter technology. So it has a 10-to-1 turndown ratio, and they also have backup drain pan heaters. They make a better efficiency with the refrigerants that they use. They make them more effective at that. We also want to see how much actual natural gas or energy you're using so we can calculate where that thermal switchover point would be. Though they're rated that low, a lot of your switchover points are maybe 15, 20 degrees where the home's a little happier, but we can get it down there if you have the right setup in your house.
What is the lifespan of these systems that are coming out now?
Sure. So you hear a lot of range on that. So you hear 10 to 15 years, 15 to 20 years, 20 plus years. What it's going to come down to is having a reputable company and getting your maintenance done on it. It's just no different than getting an oil change on a car. You want something with a good, reputable company, a good warranty, and somebody that's going to maintain it and keep up with it. So it could last, you know, 20 years, but you have to maintain it is the biggest thing.
So what is a typical maintenance need for a heat pump system?
It's no different than an air conditioner or a furnace system, because we're still going to have to check refrigerants. We still want to come out, see the furnace. We want to check the gas pressures, your voltages. We want to make sure everything's running to spec and isn't out of spec over amping or causing issues in the system.
So, but, you know, with heat pumps, when they stop at a particular temperature, is there anything that a repair tech can do to get it kicking in and heating again? Or is this strictly like a Mother Nature thing?
Perfect question. So our systems, you can actually go into the thermostat. There's even an app now, of course there is, where you can actually control the switchover points.
Oh.
So some of my more tech-savvy customers, I'll teach them how to do some of the switchovers where they could change it down if they want and see what's more comfortable for them. And maybe at 15 degrees, maybe they can go down to 10 and they like it there. Or maybe they need to go up to 20. But you can definitely switch over these units now where you want that thermal point to swap.
Let's bring in Lee in Campbell. Lee, hi. Hi, Lee. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I sure can.
Great. Go ahead.
So recently we had a sunroom remodel in our house, and we put in in-floor heat. And I just wonder how a heat pump would work in conjunction with in-floor heat.
Sure. Good question. So when you're talking about a heat pump system for in-floor, are you talking about hydronic or are you talking about electric floor heating?
Yeah, it's electric, and we have a gas furnace currently.
Okay. So we do a lot of sunrooms with a contractor. We partner with them. When you talk about a heat pump for a sunroom, because there's usually not a foundation under that, what we like to do is we actually like to put in a heat pump that's actually a ductless one. So you usually have a wall hedge unit. There's a couple of different mounted units we can put in there, floor units too. But we usually like to put those in those rooms because we don't have a foundation for ductwork under them, and we can get those down to operating temperatures in negative 13 degrees. So we can do like an air system. It doesn't bring in fresh air, but it does have a titanium air purifier built into the system, so it will louver and circulate air.
So multiple systems then at work here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Lee, thank you for that question. Jeff in Pleasant Prairie. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, your previous caller kind of asked a similar question. I have an older Wausau home built in 72, and it has baseboard radiant heating, no ductwork in the home. And I was wondering if a heat pump could work in such a home.
Is it electric baseboard?
No, it's hot water.
Hot water. So there are air to water source heat pumps where you actually have an outdoor unit that goes to a buffer tank, a manifold, and then goes into those. The only thing about hydronic heating with a heat pump is that it generally likes low temperature baseboards. It doesn't like the high temperature ones. So that's usually a bigger project. It's a little spendy to do that. You could supplement the house with a ductless system throughout the home and kind of get some air in there, but you would still have to keep some source of backup because you can't use a ductless system as your primary heat source per code in this state.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jeff, for that call. Travis Herzog with us, residential estimator, as we talk about heat pumps and those systems for home energy, 800-642-1234. Travis, as we talk about the in-floor heating and baseboard heating, I'm just wondering if you have a multi-story home, are heat pumps able to get you into the places like, you know, whether it's a room in the far back or something on a second or third level?
Yeah, good question. So that comes down to the most fun part of my job, which is air balancing. So sometimes I'll have homes that were built in the 50s, remodeled in the 70s, remodeled in the 90s, and everyone had a different idea on how the ductwork goes. So you do run into some challenges still with getting air there because it's still an air force system. And sometimes some ductwork modifications and things are needed. It just depends how many walls you have to open, those types of things to get there. But there are some tricks that we have to get the air there. We like to do variable speed motors on our furnaces, so that'll help with the variance of the air pressures. And once the first floor thermostat is satisfied, it'll still run for 20 to 30 more minutes to try to really get that air up to those upper floors.
Let's bring in Tom in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Good morning. I have two questions. One is, what is the industry doing to promote the geo systems and new construction in the state? Because I would think that would be a logical place to promote the systems. Maybe some code requirements, I don't know. That's question number one. And question number two is regarding the geo systems. What do you do if a leak is detected because the pipes are all underground and some I know are laid horizontally and others vertically, so I wouldn't know how in the world you could
Tom, thank you for that question. Short on time, I want to turn this over to Travis. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're actually part of the Wisconsin Geothermal Association, so when you work with running lines in the ground to keep them from leaking, they're actually fused polyethylene lines, and you just want to go with a really good company that's going to put that in. We actually have a driller that does it for us, but they would have to dig it up if it were to leak. But the only time you're going to spring a leak on those is if you hit it with something because they're fused. They're heat fused, so they're not going to leak. As far as new construction goes, we don't do a lot of new construction. We mostly do replacements, but we do new geo systems on new construction. But it's kind of a word-of-mouth thing, and there is a pretty large upfront expenditure to put it in there. But I do work with some builders on speccing out and load sizing for geothermal.
Are your customers taking advantage of the tax credits in progress from the federal government?
Yes. So anytime someone buys a heat pump, they go on my list for the next year, and I send out a copy of the next year's tax form. It is a credit, though, so no, you have to owe money and get the credit back. It's not a rebate. So you have to be cognizant of the fact that they're not handing you that money. You have to owe money to have that take off of your obligation.
Travis, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Travis Herzog is a residential estimator and a heat pump specialist for Midwest Heating and Cooling in Maguanago. And thank you so much to all the listeners who requested a conversation about heat pump systems. And if you have an idea for a segment we should talk about, go to WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Wisconsin, each year, hundreds of babies die before reaching their first birthday. And sudden infant death syndrome is one of the leading causes. That's from March of Dimes and its most recent state figures from 2020. We discuss the latest research on SIDS, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question or share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Kristen Seaborg is a pediatric neurologist at UW Health Kids and an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Seaborg, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Are there warning signs that an infant may be at risk for SIDS?
You know, there aren't warning signs, but we've been able to identify multiple risk factors that increase a child's risk for SIDS. For instance, if a baby is born prematurely or they have a low birth weight, they're at higher risk. Or if there's a prenatal or postnatal smoke exposure, they're at higher risk for SIDS. And also if there's a history of maternal alcohol or drug use, they're at higher risk. But most importantly, and things we can modify, is if a child has an unsafe sleep environment or what we would consider unsafe, such as co-sleeping or prone positioning at night, or having a lot of pillows around the baby while they're sleeping, can increase their risk for sudden death.
Co-sleeping, so having that infant in bed with you, what are the hazards there?
So unfortunately, when we're asleep, often adults will move around a lot. And if there's a small child next to you, it's possible to roll over onto the child or to move a blanket or a pillow that was in your portion of the bed into their space, or worse, obstructing their airway or near their airway.
Mm. When you look at the risk with smoking in the home, what is the link there and the risk of SIDS and air quality?
So it's hard to define specifically what exactly increases the risk, but certainly the air quality that an infant is exposed to in a home with where there are smokers can impact their ability to maintain normal oxygenation and normal breathing at night. There are also some unidentified or unable to discern risks with increased ear infections for parents or for children of parents that are smokers, and anything that increases upper airway secretions can increase a baby's risk of SIDS.
There is a new study in the National Library of Medicine saying there could be a link between SIDS and fever-related seizures. What is your reaction to the research?
This is a big article and really has gotten a lot of press in the neurology world. First, I just want to clarify. So this study is looking at both SIDS, but actually more importantly, a different phenomenon called sudden unexpected death in toddlers. Ah. So this study looked at 300 children that had died between the ages of 1 and 5 with no known identifying features, or it was a sudden unexpected death. And while they did show that there was a slightly increased risk of a history of febrile seizures in these children, the same amount of children had an increased history or had a current history of a upper respiratory tract infection. And all of the children that were looked at in this study were found in a prone or on their stomach position when they had their death at night.
Okay. So in terms of fevers, though, how common are fevers among infants?
Fevers are crazy common. They're a normal reaction or a normal way that a child's body can fight infection. So we do not think it's the fever itself that's dangerous. We think that's actually our body's way of fixing the infection. But there are probably some factors that we need to identify in addition to the increased upper respiratory secretions that can place them at increased risk of sudden unexpected death.
And would the research be different for infants that haven't reached the age of 1 versus babies and toddlers who are between 1 and 5?
The difference in the research is the sheer volume of the numbers. So we estimate yearly like 3,000 children die unexpectedly under the age of 18, but 92% of these are infants and 8% are between the ages of 1 and 5. So it's hard to do research on that small number, but it's such an impactful population that we'd like to learn more about.
We're talking about sudden infant death syndrome with Dr. Kristen Seaborg, who is a pediatric neurologist at UW Health Kids. You can be part of the conversation. Call in with the question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Seaborg, the National Institutes of Health says breastfeeding may help reduce the risk of SIDS. What can you tell us there?
Absolutely. So breastfeeding decreases the risk of SIDS because the positive antibodies that the mother is able to confer onto their child can decrease the risk of respiratory infections and help overall their immune system. Also, sometimes pacifiers and breastfeeding use in the middle of the night opens a child's airway and then decreases their risk of asphyxiation while they're asleep.
What about, we talked about bed sharing, but what about sharing a room with that infant? Does that have any effect on the risk of SIDS?
Sharing a room with an infant, we consider as a pediatric group, completely safe. Decreasing the risk of SIDS, hasn't been proven yet in the literature. But if a family would really like to be close to their infant at night, we definitely recommend room sharing over bed sharing.
Room sharing over bed sharing. So how can the parents and caregivers ensure safe sleep practices for their infant?
So making sure they're a safe environment, or they're sleeping in a safe environment, which would mean a child would be in a supine or on their back position, in a crib or a bassinet with no pillows or stuffed toys around them or anything that they could get onto their face. And then either sleeping in the same room or sleeping in their own crib with a baby monitor, just audio monitor is enough to be able to hear the baby at night and make sure that they are safe.
How do you keep the baby warm, though, but, you know, not too warm for sleep?
The great thing about children is they have the ability to auto-regulate and maintain their normal body temperature. Sleep sacks are safe, or just the onesies with footies are safe. But we really recommend avoiding blankets and really kind of fluffy pillows around them, because that can increase their risk of SIDS.
And, you know, after some weeks, our little infants will start to roll over. And, you know, as a mom, I've always was concerned, like, when is it okay for them to be on their tummies?
Sure. If they are strong enough to get to their tummy, then they are okay. Which is very different than you putting them on their tummy. But if they're strong enough to get to their tummy, they can lift their head up, and they can also roll back if they need to. So at that time in their life, it's okay. Still, you need to avoid the pillows and the fuzzies and the stuffies in the crib, but it's okay to let them get themselves to a prone position.
Okay, and so you would put them down on their back, but you walk in a little later or when they're asleep and you find them on their stomach, that you don't have to, like, roll them back over and put them on their back.
No, you do not. You can leave them like that.
Or, you know, when I had twins and they weren't supposed to be rolling over, but all of a sudden I walked in and, like, one was literally almost on top of the other. I'm like, oh, someone's learned to roll over.
You know? Yes. So, and that's where you can't spend all night re-rolling over the child, right?
You both So, you know, as you look at the new research coming out and in your field of neurology specifically, what might be some new aspects to explore with SIDS with the brain and neurology?
So that's an excellent question. This study is landmark because not only did they look at the children that were older than age one, but they had 7 children in their cohort of 300 that were actually being video monitored at the time of death. And they had independent researchers go through and look at these videos, and they feel conclusively that 6 of the 7 children had convulsive events around the time or at the time of their death, which raised the question of if seizures are causing their death or if they are having a seizure as they become hypoxic or have low blood flow. This in the neurology world really brings us kind of to this continuum between unexplained sudden death and a phenomenon we call SUDEP, or sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. These are both syndromes where patients or children have sudden unexpected death we can't 100% explain, but both areas need a large amount of further research so we can further decrease the chance of sudden death in children, especially children with epilepsy.
In the meantime, Dr. Seaborg, how should a parent or caregiver be caring for that seizing infant?
In the meantime, the best thing you can do for a child with epilepsy, and I'll answer the other part in a second, is make sure they get their medications, make sure they have a safe sleep environment, and ensure as much as you can that they get adequate sleep. In a child with a history of febrile seizures or who doesn't have a history of epilepsy at all, then the advice goes back to what we were just talking about. Just make sure they're in a safe sleep environment and that they're, if we can, not being exposed to any external smoke or anything else that might make their environment unsafe, such as co-sleeping.
Pediatric neurologist Kristen Seaborg bringing us the latest on sudden infant death syndrome and neurological complications in infants and children with this new study. Call in with the question. You can add your perspective at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine potential causes of sudden infant death syndrome and the latest research on the unforeseen and unexplained death of a baby younger than one. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Kristen Seaborg with us, a pediatric neurologist at UW Health Kids. Let's go to Catherine in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi. What is your question?
Hi. I'm just wondering, how is this being communicated to the broader community of expectant parents, even caregivers, really? Is there an initiative by certain agencies? Just wanting to know, how's the word getting out about best practices?
Sure. So do you mean the most recent research about potential increased risk for children with seizures?
That, or just in general, this topic mm-hmm. in general. I'm not a parent, but I have a great nephew who's expecting. And so I'm, you know, my antenna is up for all of this information.
So for the risks of SIDS, which is the sudden infant death syndrome for children under the age of one, the American Academy of Pediatrics, or www.aap.org, has a wonderful webpage and very in-breadth knowledge about SIDS and ways you can prevent SIDS. For older children, greater than age one, for sudden unexpected death, our cohort and our research is very small. So the study that I'm referencing today looked at 300 children, and we don't have enough information to change the guidelines of the recommendations, but we are focusing on more research in this population. There is a sudden unexpected death in children, or SUDC, research group that you can also reference on the internet for most recent guidance and recommendations.
I wonder, is SIDS a topic for prenatal visits or follow-up care after that baby is born?
Often. It's mentioned in the hospital after the baby is born. It's mentioned at the early well-child visits. It's a very common topic that is discussed routinely.
How do you approach counseling parents who've experienced the loss of a child due to SIDS?
Goodness, empathy and understanding. There's absolutely no way to cast any blame or, say you should have done this. There is a slightly increased risk of SIDS in another child in the future, just because we're concerned there's a small genetic correlation. However, our counseling is just more for support and to make sure that the family is aware of safe sleep practices and decreasing their exposures to things like smoke in the home.
You know, technology and artificial intelligence, it's all around us, Dr. Seaborg. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. could technology help prevent a situation like this?
We don't know how it can prevent yet, but we do know how it can detect, or at least make us more prone to capturing a child when they're in a risky situation. As I'm sure you're aware, there are a lot of video monitors that we can place in an infant's room. A lot of them are motion and sound detected. These are, in my opinion, somewhat a double-edged sword because a child moves multiple times in the middle of the night. If you're getting woken up every single time, it's harder to respond when something's really going on.
Right.
The market is actually, there's a lot of research and we're getting closer to developing peer-reviewed and approved seizure detection devices that children with epilepsy can wear at night. None of these yet are FDA approved, but there's a lot of research on the technology that would be able to detect a seizure before it happens or while it's happening in a child in the middle of the night.
So it seems that the medical side of the research and the technology side are also converging here to try to figure out a path forward for how to prevent these sudden deaths.
Absolutely. There's nothing worse for a parent or a family to experience a sudden unexpected death. So we are trying our hardest for multiple avenues to attack this and prevent it as much as we can.
What are some common misconceptions surrounding SIDS?
I think there's a lot of common misconception about even if I put a blanket or a pillow in my child's crib, they'll be just fine. As I'm sure you're aware, in the community, the evidence of co-sleeping is unequivocal that it can place an increased risk of SIDS. But a lot of families are concerned that if they're not co-sleeping, they won't be close enough to their child in order to detect other things. So I think we need to continue to attack those misunderstandings or those misconceptions to get our children to sleep in a safe environment outside of their parents' bed.
And in that crib, you know, it's not just the blankets and the stuffies or a pillow soft thing. It's also like those crib bumpers that tie at the corners. Those too can be, I understand, quite harmful.
They're super cute, right?
They are. Yeah. They go with the decor of the room.
I know, but unfortunately, yes, they can be quite harmful. And then I've heard too, families will say, but what if they get their head right next to the railing on the crib? That could hurt them. And, you know, they'll move away from that. And even if they did have a bruise on their forehead, sure, that's much less risky than asphyxiation or losing your breathing at night. So we'd go over safety over cuteness of the bedroom.
Yeah, and those cribs also, the cribs have to certainly be up to code as well as to how wide those slats are. There are certainly regulations around that. So as long as that crib is, I would imagine, a more current model, that there wouldn't be a concern there.
Correct. Current model, there are very, very strict regulations. And so I would have an up-to-date crib that's made within the last 10 to 20 years at most.
You know, does the age of either parent have an impact on the risk of SIDS? Is there any research in that area?
There's no research that I can find. The only kind of correlation but causation I could potentially discern is there's a slightly increased risk of prematurity in younger moms. And we know that prematurity is associated with a higher SIDS risk. So perhaps we could correlate those two things, but I can't prove that younger age of parents is associated with higher risk of SIDS.
Dr. Kristen Seaborg with us as we talk about sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. Dr. Seaborg is a pediatric neurologist at UW Health Kids. You can call in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Dr. Seaborg, this is also quite sensitive, but detecting the cause of death to be SIDS, what does that entail?
It's actually a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning we've excluded everything else before we call it sudden unexplained infant death. So what that usually entails is autopsy, sampling, looking for genetic differences that predispose a child to having sudden death, cardiac differences that could cause a sudden arrhythmia. And often we look at brain samples to see if there's anything different about a brain that would make a child more prone to sudden death. It's not a pretty diagnosis, but unfortunately, that's often the way that things pursue before a child is diagnosed with that.
Is there an ability to learn a lot more about SIDS through autopsies?
We're working on that. To take these brain samples or pathology samples and look a little bit closer. There's actually some ongoing studies right now. I have one in front of me. Pathologists looking at the tissues in the cells and trying to determine if there's something different that makes a child prone to SIDS.
That's really interesting. Where do you see SIDS research headed, especially in terms of your specialty?
I think it would be really, so the most recent study that looked at the videos of these 7 children that died suddenly can give us a lot of information that's happening around the time of death. It's impossible for us to predict when SIDS or sudden unexpected death in children will happen, but I think it would be helpful to have more video or EEG data for children at risk of SIDS or sudden unexpected death. And perhaps that way we can figure out the kind of the consistent things that we see in these children and identify their risks.
But it's also, you have to balance that with an infant doesn't want to be hooked up to monitors while they're trying to sleep and rest, because we also know that infant sleep is so important. So you want to advance the science, and yet you don't want to let these babies sleep.
And you have completely identified at least part of the kind of barrier that we have to doing research on children like this. That, and really nobody wants to, it's hard to research sudden infant death once the child has passed. So it's a very tricky area to research, but you're absolutely right. It's hard to do research on young children.
We only have a few seconds left, but how important is sleep to infants?
It is imperative for infants to have safe and effective sleep. It can affect their development and can affect their daytime function and their ability to learn and grow throughout the day.
Dr. Seaborg, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing the latest on this topic. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kristen Seaborg is a pediatric neurologist at UW Health Kids and an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can visit our program page to stream or download more programs from The Morning Show. Visit wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.